Hi, I'm Fanny Blanc and this is Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning in fostering change in contemporary society. In this episode, I'll be talking with Ulises Moreno Tavares. Ulises is an interdisciplinary geographer developing what he calls spectral geographies, spatial poetics, and politics of presence and absence concerning ecological and cultural landscapes. Ulises is also a postdoctoral associate with the Department of Geography and Environment at the LSC and a dear colleague and friend of mine. I'm so happy to have him on this episode today. So Ulises, can you tell me a bit more about your region?
So first, thank you for having me on. I miss you very much and I'm thankful for the opportunity to collaborate with you and to talk about my research. Apologies up front because you will likely hear a lot of ambient noise. I live in Ometepec, Guerrero, Mexico, and it's a really small city, and it's the loudest city I've lived in. And I lived in Beijing, in London, and Los Angeles. So that says a lot. Literally that which passed by says a lot. Anyway, I work in the coastal regions of Guerrero, Mexico. This is my home state. It's located in southwestern Mexico. The coastal regions of Guerrero are divided into three, the Costa Grande, the north side in Acapulco, and Costa Chica, with Acapulco being at the center and Costa Chica being at the southern part. It's a historic site of encounters for various Mesoamerican cultures. Up in the mountain region, there's the Atoyac River, which flows down to the coastal municipality where I was born. It's also known as Rio Balsas. This is the place where corn is believed to have been domesticated some 10,000 years ago. It's difficult to know where to start.
And how about prior to the arrival of Cortes?
Okay, so Acapulco has historically been a border zone between established cultures. The Costa Grande was home to the Cihuatlán culture and other groups which were conquered by the Mexica, the Aztec Empire. So this was prior to the arrival of Cortes. And what is now the Costa Chica was inhabited by the Yope culture. This is one of the few groups that the Mexica could not conquer. The Mexica could not enter this territory, so they would meet in Acapulco for trade and diplomatic relations. And they would enter, of course, with permission and supervision. The Yope also resisted Spanish conquest, but eventually fell to disease and disbanded as a kingdom. The groups that remain, they call themselves Tlapaneco, or MEPA, and they continue to wage fierce resistance against predatory mining companies, particularly the Canadian ones. But that's more of a contemporary struggle.
All right, that's super interesting. And what happened during the colonial era?
I think there's two important elements to highlight in this era, a shipping port and plantations. So during the colonial era, Acapulco became one of the most important, if not the most important, shipping port along the Pacific coastline. The Spanish crown ruled the Philippines from Acapulco and traded with Asian merchants in Manila for 2.5 centuries, from 1565 to 1815. So these ships were known as the Manila Galleons, and they traded luxury goods such as spices and porcelains in exchange for the highly valued silver found in New Spain. This silver primarily came from the city of Taxco, which is in the mountain region of Guerrero. And nowadays, you'll find a lot of Filipino descendants in the coastal regions, primarily around Acapulco. There was some migration back and forth, though this remains not so well documented historically. But I think one of the most important dishes in this region, at least in Tecpan and in the Costa Grande, is relleno. It's a local variation of rellenong manok. I'm not sure which one came first, but there was obviously some influence. It's roasted pig stuffed with fruits and veggies, marinated in soy sauce, and it's usually served on a bolillo, a version of the French baguette, smaller, but equally as delicious. And it's influenced from the French migrants, but that came around 1800s or so. So during the same time, the colonial period, plantations were popping up all over the place in what is now Central Mexico, including Guerrero, which wasn't called Guerrero then, but we're talking about sugarcane plantations here and other monocultural crops. So as indigenous peoples kept dying from new diseases, New Spain brought enslaved peoples from West Africa to work on these plantations. And marooned slaves or enslaved peoples who had escaped from these plantations would often end up in what is now Costa Chica. This area extends from Acapulco to arguably the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in Oaxaca. Arguably because in Oaxaca, the regions aren't bordered up in terms of technical mappings. There's not an official charting like there is in Guerrero. Like the Costa Chica is an official region in Guerrero, but that's not the case in Oaxaca. And so some people say it extends to the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. Others say that it extends to Puerto Escondido. Anyway, it's rough terrains. And they weren't very well connected, so it was a good place for refuge. Of course, there's a long and complicated history of encounters between Black and Indigenous peoples, but over time, with the mixtures of cultures and biology, this became an Afro-Indigenous geography, because again, its characteristics and its the meshworks that occur as a consequence of these encounters, which weren't always friendly, always complicated, fraught, but it's what we have and it's what we work with still.
I see. And does the region still maintain that characteristic in the post-colonial era?
Yes, but it's complicated. So the state of Guerrero is named after Vicente Guerrero, the first Black president of a country in the Americas. There's an interesting story of how Acapulco could have become a city governed by Afro descendants. So prior to the War of Independence in 1810, there was a man named Mariano Tavares. He was the son of an important merchant in the Manila Galleons. And I want to say that he was my great-great-great-granduncle or something, but I haven't been able to access archival records yet. And anyway, as far as I know, the last name Tavares is a name that was given to African slaves who were owned by Portuguese merchants. Alas, Tavares was fed up with white Spaniards having control of the port of Acapulco, so he launched and won an important battle, ousting them from the city. So his victory caught the attention of a man named Jose Maria Morelos, himself an Afro-descendant man. The two became friends, and they had kind of competing visions of how to fight for independence. Tavares wanted Acapulco and actually the whole coastal regions to be a city governed by Afro descendants, by Black peoples. And Morelos wanted white allies. He had a vision of a post-racial society where people were not racially categorized. So on paper, the Spanish crown had about 16 categories for their caste system. There's debate about how this actually worked on the ground, but it was there. And so Morelos had Tavares killed, and he went on to become a national hero because of his role in independence. And so on paper, Mexico became a post-racial, post-caste liberal society, but that structure, which stratified peoples using identity categories, remained in place, not just in culture, but also in terms of the legal system, particularly the land tenure system. So this was one of the core struggles that led to the revolution of 1910, which ousted hacendados. Hacendados were basically whiter, richer people with ownership of large swaths of land, often used for agrarian production. So fast forward to around the 1940s and 50s, after the Mexican Revolution, Acapulco became basically one of the hottest tourist destinations. It was a beautiful paradise, incredible beaches, great weather. Famous artists and movie stars from around the world would go there on holiday. So historians call it the golden age of Acapulco. And so meanwhile, in the Costa Grande, in the 60s and 70s, there were peasant struggles around government control of the coconut market. The government used the military to suppress peasant resistance, including massacres and forced disappearances. So this gave rise to two famous revolutionary figures, one of them named Lucio Cabañas and the other one named Genaro Vázquez. Lucio Cabañas was an uncle of mine. He led an armed struggle to call attention to political corruption and structural abandonment, especially in terms of health and education. Education primarily was his thing, as he was a school teacher. So this led to what is known as the Dirty Wars, where the military tortured and disappeared many people living in rural areas in the Sierras of Atoyac, where I grew up later. This also included several family members, uncles, cousins, all of whom are registered in the official reports from truth commissions, which list disappeared peoples as a result of these dirty wars. So yes, the region still maintains an Afro-Indigenous character, but the struggles that have defined the region historically haven't really used that language to make justice claims. Peasant resistance and land reform would be, I guess, two keywords that bring together different subject identifications in the regions. This isn't to say that race and caste haven't been at work in these struggles. I would argue, as I do in my work, that they've been a central component, but that requires more in-depth and nuanced analysis. And of course, like I said, that's what I try to do in my work.
Okay, so you mentioned possible family members and actual family members from the region. So what is your relationship to this geography?
Yeah, so first I want to say that for me, I grew up here and I left at the age of 10 to the United States. And so we migrated, but I didn't really know about these histories until I came back to Mexico and I made it my research topic and I delved into it. So finding those things like the official reports from truth commissions and finding out that Lucio Cabañas was an uncle of mine and that I have cousins and uncles that were disappeared during the Dirty Wars is new information, and it's all kind of difficult to digest in its own emotional realm, which one can't separate oneself from. I can't separate myself from that. But yeah, it's a work in progress. And I think having this idea of being an academic kind of helps remove myself in some ways. It gives me like a shield to confront these histories, some of which my own family didn't know about. But as I sort of dig up the records and I share them on Facebook, those kinds of things become really shocking for a lot of my cousins, for instance. But yes, I was born in the coastal municipality of San Jerónimo. I grew up in the Sierra of Atoyac, which is 2 hours north of Acapulco. As I mentioned earlier, my great-grandparents are on the Tavares side of the family. As far as I can tell, come from Acapulco, and my great-grandparents on the Moreno side come from Costa Chica, specifically in the San Marcos municipality, 2 hours south of Acapulco and 2 hours north of where I am now, which is Ometepec, the loudest, smallest city that I've ever lived in. It's unceded Musgo territory, though given its history, it is now, as I mentioned, an Afro-Indigenous geography. I am Afro-descendant by way of both sets of parents. And I would even argue that most of us from these coastlines that are born in these coastlines are Afro-descendant. But there's a long history of whitening, and this identity category is technically something new. For instance, in 2019, Mexico became the last Latin American country to recognize Black and Afro-descendant peoples as an ethnic group. So we didn't really have the language to claim these histories and organize around these politics. Again, it's a post-racial, post-caste society that was formed after the revolution, but it didn't really address the leftover structures that were hardened by those kinds of structural politics which privileged whiter and richer peoples, Europeans. And so now we do have that language, primarily due to the efforts from people living in the Costa Chica region. My paternal grandma was an Afro-Indigenous woman. I want to say she was likely Tlapaneca because of the region where she was born, San Marcos. But I can't really say for sure. I mean, I don't have cultural ties to this group. So, and I don't speak the language. I didn't grow up around them. I did grow up with a Nahuatl family in the Costa Grande, but they were also migrants who had moved there to work, basically. And I don't have, these are histories that have been systematically erased through a lot of cultural aesthetics, where, again, identifications with whiter, richer subjectivities are preferred because of the remnants of that caste system and its ongoing effects on what is racism. So yeah, that's my territory and my relation to it. I mean, it's more complex than that, but that gives you a bit of a history. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to reflect and speak about this at length.
Of course, and in your work, you explore the development of Afro-Indigenous politics in Costa Chica of Guerrero, particularly in relation to climate change. Why is the Afro-Indigenous population more impacted by climate change, and what is the role of planning in this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I should preface the answer by saying that I'm not a planner and that I don't know where my understanding of development fits within the discipline of development or planning studies for that matter. I'm not really faithful to any discipline. That said, I'm interested in understanding the intimacies of climate change. I mean, we know that climate change is a global phenomenon, but its impacts are experienced on a local scale. It disrupts a lot of the intimate relations between humans and non-humans and their environments. And so for me, these disruptions need to be thought of as a social justice issue. It's a forced disruption, which means that there's power imbalances at work. So in this way, climate change is an environmental justice issue. And I like to think of Professor Farhana Sultana, And how she reminds us that environmental justice is climate justice, is water justice, is gender justice, is racial justice, is decolonial justice, is social justice. And I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that we have to think about the various, we have to think about the various interconnections that are possible from a very local and intimate scale. I mean, climate change affects us all differently because of, you know, geography, geology, not to mention the social, cultural, and economic factors that are at work in a historic, present, and future context. And I mean, it's interesting that you ask about planning. I mean, aside from the fact that this is a planning podcast and everything, but I think of planning as a discipline inherently about the future. And yet, whatever planning there is, it needs to be anchored to all of these spatial-temporal dynamics. For me, I like to think of the plantation as one of the key sites that opens up the connections between development, planning, climate change, and environmental justice. There's a lot of work that's being done using the concept of the plantationocene. This concept is related to the Anthropocene, the age of man. But it takes plantations instead of humans as the key drivers of climate change. So here I'm thinking of the work of Wendy Walford, Catherine McKittrick, Anna Singh, and others. And I like this concept, you know, but I think its logic, or the logic of the plantation, is stretched thin. Nonetheless, I think it does go a long way in explaining the ecological, and we have to work to explain the racialized elements of climate change. Oftentimes, this is sidestepped, and I think a lot of the work that is emerging in critical race theory avoids that kind of sidestepping, connecting ecology and race as intimately linked at the site of the plantation. And obviously there's others, but this is one site where one can work and build theory, analysis, etc.
All right. Could you elaborate on that? How do plantations explain climate change?
Yes, I'm changing rooms, by the way. There's less noise in this other room, but there's a bit of an echo. So anyway, plantations in the Americas and other geographies are a product of slavery and colonialism. So this includes various configurations of dispossession, enslavement, and genocide of peoples who are racialized as Black and Indigenous. So these plantations are also constituted by ecocide, where the flora and fauna have continually been drastically altered or eradicated in favor of monocultural plantations or monocultural crops. So the relation to territory is something that becomes commodified on a large scale, and it keeps growing, especially when the Industrial Revolution kicks into gear with the onset of technology and all that. So it is at this point that one can understand the magnitude of the ongoing impact. And all of this development along its synonyms like progress, evolution, maturing, success, etc., it's all achieved through various forms of violence towards humans and non-humans. And because we're talking about slavery and colonialism, this requires specifying the power relations between human actors. I guess what I'm saying here is that it's not the plantation that inherently inflicts such terror upon humans. It's the plan and plantation, the planning of the plantation, the systematic organization of colonial violence, its implementation, and its afterlives. And again, especially its afterlives and what we have to live with as a consequence of that. There's a wonderful book called Sweetness and Power by Sidney Mintz, which demonstrates how sugar plantations influenced infrastructure and urbanization processes in the Americas and in Europe. So what I'm saying here is that Black, Indigenous, and Afro-Indigenous populations in the Americas have felt the impact of climate change because they have been placed on the receiving end of plantation violence, namely slavery and colonialism. So if the effects of climate change on humans include impacts on health, environment, displacement, forced migration, security, loss of biodiversity, etc., then Black and Indigenous peoples have been experiencing these impacts as a consequence of the different structural iterations of racialized global capitalism. And so that's how plantations, for me, help me to explain climate change and the power dynamics that are associated with that, the social justice politics that are opened as a consequence of plantation. Obviously, it's not the only logic that can be used to explain, climate change, but it's one that is an important one. So that's what I'm arguing here.
And what does resistance look like in Costa Chica?
So that's a really difficult question. I mean, I've come to think of resistance as being where one looks for it. So resistance is found where one looks for it. I think that that's problematic, obviously, because the magnitude and the impact of that resistance varies. But in terms of the coastal regions of Guerrero, I think despite the ongoing challenges, the encounter between Black and Indigenous peoples is indeed marked by resistance to the different trajectories of climate change and global capitalism. So I think this resistance is evident in people's relation to the territory. It's not understood as a commodity, the territory. It's understood as a source of life that must be protected. So the flora and fauna are sometimes ascribed mythical aesthetic that reflects different elements of Amerindian, European, African, and sometimes even Asian spiritualities. And of course, some people who live here and have lived here all their lives will say that that's not true, that they'll contest that statement, right? That the territory is not understood as a commodity. But it is one understanding of the territory that is continually marginalized. And so it's still evident, at least in a lot of indigenous cultures, as well as Afro-descendant cultures, primarily through cultural rituals. You can tell based on that. And so it's impressive, I think, that these life worlds are able to flourish, that these encounters with their rituals and traditions are able to flourish despite the forces that have been slavery and colonialism as co-constitutive economic structurations of the world. So I'm not trying to overemphasize Afro-Indigenous resistance, but I think it's important to highlight the different human nature relations that are possible where the environment does not factor as a lifeless spatiality with an endless amount of resources. I do want to emphasize the role of the Mexican state and transnational corporations, such as Canadian mining companies, in continuing the plantation and mining violence. So in the state of Guerrero, deforestation has caused significant environmental concerns. Deforestation happened through legal and non-legal means, and in the past 40 years, the federal government has incentivized massive deforestations and destruction of wetlands to open up land for plantation projects and livestock, or even monocultural crops. But there are relatively small-scale projects because of how the land ownership system is organized. But in aggregate form, they amount to large swaths of land that decrease soil water capture in the mountains and increase the vulnerability in flooding to flooding in the lowlands and the coastal regions. So having said that, I do want to place this question about who is affected more by climate change in the context of current global environmental politics. So we know that the global north consumes and uses many more resources and produces more emissions than the global south does. So once again, this becomes a question about environmental justice, forced disruptions between geographically situated humans and their environments. So if we wanted to use the language of the plantation to frame this conversation, we can argue that the larger the plantation system, the higher the stakes for both the plantation as well as the environment. In the context of global capitalism, this entails different forms of resource extraction from the global south in service of the global north. And there are more nuanced arguments about the role of the global east and Southeast Asia in this context. I think Hyun Shin's work is important in this regard, adding more spatial complexity to this debate, which bifurcates the world into binary cardinal directions. In terms of planning on a national scale, the current Mexican government is betting on fossil fuels as a development policy. This includes mega infrastructural projects such as the Trans-Isthmus Corridor of Tehuantepec, which basically borders the Costa Chica of Oaxaca, which I mentioned earlier. So this infrastructural project comprises agricultural plantations, urbanization, energy infrastructure, 10 industrial parks, and a train traversing the states of Veracruz and Oaxaca, basically so as to compete with the Panama Canal. And it's bound to continue the historical plantation violence because of its significant environmental impacts. Matt Birkinshaw and I are working on a project to situate these environmental politics on a broader historical framework. It's a work in progress now, but we do try to highlight some of the ground resistance that's happening. Resistance is a work in progress, and the forces that are at work are indeed massive.
You're one of the main figure of the group Environmental Racism is Garbage, which seeks knowledge production and acts of resistance at the intersection of art, politics, and the relationship between racialized injustice and ecological crisis. The group looks into waste as a symptom of environmental racism. Could you tell me a bit more about this initiative?
This was a really fun project to work on. I worked on it with Katsu Lopez and Amairani Martinez, two indigenous artist activists of the Amuzgo peoples in Xochitlahuaca in the mountain area, and Aide Rodriguez, an Afro-Mexican artist working in Cuajinicuilapa in the coastal area. So ours was one of 14 exhibits that were featured. It's all documented and archived at environmentalracismisgarbage.art. And if you want to check out any of the exhibits, there's 14 of them. The password is waste2021, the number 2021. Waste 2021 for all exhibits. So our project sought to document environmental racism in Mexico, Guerrero, and Costa Chica region. For this project, we focus on mining activity. We document how previous government administrations in the past two decades awarded 24,000 mining exploration and exploitation concessions that cover an area of 17 million hectares of land. 9% of the Mexican national territory. The ways in which the mining concessions were awarded is questionable at the very least. This includes not consulting indigenous groups as constitutional law requires, or not categorizing them as indigenous because, for instance, there was a church in the city, and instead of asking people how they identified, the surveyors, which awarded the concessions, they just awarded the concessions without categorizing people as indigenous. So anyway, in Guerrero, there are 267 mining companies with foreign and national capital, which are in operation. And together they see about 917 mining projects, of which 70% are of Canadian origin. So most of these mining projects are located in the neighboring mountainous regions, such as Cochuapa El Grande in La Montaña, a municipality that is connected to the Costa Chica through various waterways. So these waterways include the San Pedro River, which flows down through the major municipalities such as Xochistlahuaca, Ometepec, Huajinicuilapa, all the way down to the Pacific Ocean. So together, we produced a report documenting the mining situation in the country, the state, and the region, the mountain region, as well as the way the interconnections and the ways that region connects to the Costa Chica through the waterways that we mentioned. So in other words, if the waterways are corrupted, contaminated, poisoned in the mountains, that will flow down here to the Costa Chica. And so our work, particularly the artwork, documents the different cultural and ecological lifescapes that are intertwined and that could be in danger if mining activity in the mountain is allowed to continue to go forward. So yeah, that's our project. And you can check out the artwork, at least, at, again, environmentalracismisgarbage.art, and the password is waste2021.
And Ulysses, what are your hopes for the future of your region?
So I think that there's a lot of value in documenting the histories of these coastal regions and connecting these histories to contemporary phenomena, climate change being one of the most important ones, because as a coastal region, it's susceptible to the associated impacts like sea level rise, which will likely wreak havoc on an already vulnerable geography. And I think it's a really beautiful place, especially during the rainy season. It reminds me of London, but with much better weather. I would love to see reforestation projects, locally led sustainable development projects, as opposed to the centralized projects, which always devalue local knowledge and ways of being. And oftentimes that includes the local politics, which can upend any kind of central government's goodwill or good policy that they may have for planning. And that's usually the case, right, where central planning policy is thwarted by local dynamics. And so I think that that's something that needs to be considered here. Value local knowledge and ways of being, and cooperate with that, use it. So as for me, I think I'd like to be part of an ongoing collaborative effort to draw from the region's rich history to shape political subjectivity in theory, art, social science, ultimately to positively and urgently contribute to the discourses and practices around climate change. So that's my hope for the region.
Thank you, Ulysses.
Thank you so much for having me. I probably went much longer than your other guests, but it's a pleasure thinking about all this with you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you, Ulysses, for speaking with me today. For more information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lsc.ac.uk/progressingplanning. thanks to the Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund at LSE for sponsoring this episode. Next episode, we'll be talking with Calm Ward, a fellow at the Geography Department at LSE. See you soon!